The topic for today is responsible U.S. lifestyles. I probably should have put in there responsible Christian U.S. lifestyles, but I guess I assume we they're one and the same for many people that are here. Thank you. During the week, we've looked at a number of different topics, and most of those topics have been sessions in themselves, so that if you didn't come to the first one, you could come to the second one and it would make no difference. I'm afraid that today, even though the topics we discussed, some of them will be new, it is in a way a summary of what's happened during the week. And so I just want to briefly say what we did during the week. We looked at several problems, did a little analysis, tried to get some tools so that we could understand the problems better. First, we looked at capitalism as an economic system. I said something about the definition of economics, unlimited wants, limited resources, and how do you allocate those efficiently. But the key is with unlimited wants, we always want growth. It's very important to capitalism. Then we looked at briefly at the costs and the benefits of economic growth. The next session, during that session we were doing Reagan economics, because supply-side economics, supply does relate to economic growth. In the next session we dealt with the energy problem. What is it? The last session was on inflation. And what I'd like to do today is to look at the future. What does the future hold? What should it look like? My background is economic development of third world countries. So for quite some time I've dealt with economic development, and as I became a little more aware of what was going on, realized that it's really economic development within the context of human development. But that's where I've done most of my work. It's only been in the last year and a half that I've been asking questions more seriously about the United States. And are we overdeveloped? Those kinds of issues. So what I'm going to do today is fairly new to me, and I want to give you a chance to respond to some different scenarios that we can present for the future, give you a chance to respond to some of the issues that we dealt with earlier in the week, if you'd like to bring those back up, and then eventually talk about a simpler, more responsible lifestyle. I'll do that at the end. There's some things that I'd like to say about it, some little, I don't know if I can say tips that I'd like to give, but it's kind of a scary thing in a way. And so I would like to have a few minutes at the end to summarize what I see is to be an important response to these problems. I think, too, that as I get older and maybe a little wiser, I begin to feel more and more that it's not a good idea to leave the future in the hands of the experts. The experts have become so specialized and so narrow that I think it's pretty dangerous. And so the kind of things we're talking about today, I think, are important for everybody. And wherever you come from, doesn't make any difference to me, whatever you want to say. I'm really here to get a little feedback. I'd like to learn a little bit about what you have to say, and the floor will really be open after I present the material that's on these two boards. And I'll try to do that as briefly as possible. I'm making a few assumptions. First of all, I'm only going to look at five scenarios or the look views of the future. Many feel that in the next 30, 40 years, it's going to be a very important time as we look at some of these alternatives, because of the way things are changing so rapidly. And the future is going to affect each and every one of us. So we might just as well be involved in it rather than passively sitting by and letting it happen. What we've done so far this week is, I think, first of all, we tried to predict what might happen if we don't act. And so with inflation, and we don't know how to sacrifice very well to get rid of inflation. With the energy problem, if we don't act, is can capitalism handle some of these problems? We've looked at those. We tried to predict what might happen if we sat back and let things continue as they were. Second, we have tried to forecast, and not we haven't done a real good job of this, but we tried to forecast to some extent what might happen if, in our case, what will happen with the Reagan administration? Where are we going? What I'd like to do now is try and decide what we want to happen as we look into the future. What do we really want to happen? And then it's time we start planning how to help make it happen and how to act responsibly. in, I would say, a revolutionary world, in a very changing world. So I'll give you the first five scenarios. The first one is, let's see if I... The first one is business as usual. It means that the future will look very much like the present and the past. Economic growth will be important. As far as politics is concerned, we'll operate as a nation state. We'll work with the party systems that we have. Economics will have a real stress on goods, material things, especially manufacturing, even though we are moving into the services. As far as we're concerned with social welfare, well-being, it'll probably be performed by professional people. The changes and the crises will continue as they have in the past, but the main problems are not going to change very drastically from what they are today. We'll keep struggling with these problems. The methods for handling the problems will not be much different. We've talked a little bit about Keynesian economics in here, a little Friedman economics, but it's business as usual. People's attitudes will not change a great deal. Now, people who take this point of view tend to be characterized, I hope that I'm not going to insult anybody now, but tend to be characterized as though they're very pragmatic people. They're problem solvers. They're good operators. They're successful troubleshooters. A problem here, try and solve it. Put another fire out over here. They're moderate reformers. Sure, we want change, but in moderation. People who are content with their present position or the future prospects within this existing system, too, will support this. In other words, the status quo would tend to be supportive of this. There is another group, too, those who are defeatists and cynics often will support this simply because they're convinced we cannot change the system and they're not even prepared to try. So those are some of the people who just say business as usual, what we've done the last, at least in economic terms, the last 25 years, we'll continue with more of the same. The second scenario is one called disaster. It says that things are beginning to break down catastrophically. In fact, moral blindness is often considered to be one of the major threats. To give you some examples, we've talked about the energy problem, what capitalism can do or can't do, inflation and unemployment. What about growth? And many see that there are no, because of these kind of problems we've talked about, they see no realistic alternatives to nuclear war, every weapon we've created, we've used eventually, unrest, growing unrest, famine, pollution, poverty, misery, disease, crime, those kinds of things, inevitable. It's going to be a disaster is coming, both at the national level and the international level. Now, this scenario appeals to people who are pessimists. The future is, we're doomed. And the hellfire merchants and preachers and doomsters who like to make people feel uncomfortable. The third scenario is a totalitarian conservationist future. It looks similar to number two. The risk of disaster is very real, but the best way to avert it is to accept an authoritarian system of government. In other words, we're willing to give up some of our freedoms to a sovereign power, some authoritative power, who will then enforce law and order and distribute the limited resources we have fairly so that we get a forced change in lifestyle, conservation, and it's really the only way to get the sacrifices that are needed. History shows that people often turn to authority in times of chaos. Uncontrolled individual greed, by the way, I didn't say anything about this yesterday, but Schumacher's theory of inflation is based in about one word, greed. It's about how he sums it up. Uncontrolled greed destroys the common good. Now, who does this appeal to? It appeals to people who think they have more to lose from disorder than they have to lose from some dictatorship. People who are authoritarian, dominating in temperament. People who take a low view of others. You can't change human nature. People aren't capable of making changes. And so, you see, this is the least of two evils. The fourth scenario, the hyper-expansionist future. And I don't mean to associate... Oh, by the way, Heilbronner could be associated with 2 and 3. Heilbronner talks about the human prospect and talks about disaster, but does imply that maybe a totalitarian conservationist solution will be the right one. The hyper-expansionist future is Herman Kahn, and someone put Daniel Bell in this category. It's not Reagan. I mean, I don't see this one as Reagan, even though we're talking about expansion and growth. I think Reagan's growth fits more as business as usual. We aren't doing anything on supply-side economics except rediscovering the supply side of economics. We just ignored it for a while. So hyper-expansionist says we're going to break out of our present problems by accelerating super-industrialist drives by the North and those in the West. We're going to make more effective use of science and technology. Now, I have not studied in the area of futures. I'm not really a futurist, so I can't elaborate to a great extent on this, and so I would like to have input from some of you if you'd like to pick up on that. But whenever I read anything by Herman Kahn, or whenever I hear Herman Kahn, I just can't believe how optimistic he is with respect to science and technology. And as far as scarce resources, he says we haven't begun to tap the resources of the Earth, for example. Okay. Now, I put this one in here for the benefit of Larry Rasmussen. This is what it's going to look like. Space colonization, nuclear power, a lot of emphasis on computers and computing, and genetic engineering. All of this will enable us to overcome all of these limits we're afraid of. Scarce resources. Space colonization might open that up. Energy problems. Nuclear power will solve it. Intelligence and diminishing returns there. Computers. I heard not too long ago, at least I read in the paper, that they are programming computers to think for themselves now. That is beginning. Maybe I also have here, maybe this appeals to the Star Trek crowd. I don't know. And as far as biology is concerned, we have genetic engineering. All nations will develop under this system. The poor countries will have a great future, and we will stress services more and more, whereas the poor countries will stress manufacturing. We'll have a comparative advantage in the services, they'll move up to the manufacturing. Who does this appeal to? This appeals to people who are very optimistic, energetic, ambitious, and competitive. It's for people who think that economic, money, wealth, and technical achievement is far more significant than personal or social growth. Those who look at this see this as a very exciting future. Then the fifth scenario is a sane, humane, ecological future called the she future. This one was the he future. By the way, I should tell you where this is coming from. I'm sorry. There's a fellow who has written extensively, I think, in England, but not as well read over here. His name is Jim Robertson, and he's written the same alternative. It happened that a small group in Twin Cities to me means Minneapolis, St. Paul, picked up the rights to the book, and I don't think they're getting it distributed very well, but many feel it's one of the best books to date on where we go in the future. I'll say more about a few resources at the end, too, things to look at. It's really a very unique little book. I think it's as good as anything I've seen. But remember, I don't have a vast experience in the area, but I think it's a really good book. Okay, the sane, humane, ecological future says that we need to change direction. It's not so much opposed to growth, but it says, as far as economics and technical things go, we need to stress balance. Balance within ourselves, balance with other people, maybe the north-south, and balance with nature. Future expansion will be more in the area of social and psychological growth and not economic and technical. I can't elaborate on that a great deal, but it says a lot about giving top priority to learning how to live with one another and to be supportive and to live within a closed system. Decentralization is important, And then, I couldn't see very well that day that someone asked me about the informal economy. Is by any chance that person here today who said, in gross national product, you measure only the goods that move through the market, but there's a big informal economy going on. And I knew there was something about that in this book, so I've been reading it the last couple of days. And it says there'll be more emphasis on the informal market. In the informal market, money does not change hands, but there is an enormous amount of production taking place. I'll give you one example. I always give this in class. I ask the students, do you know what the homemaker, the housewife, would earn if she performed the same services outside the home at the going wage rate? And I ask for estimates. Problem is, the data is a little old. But when you get all done calculating them, maybe I'll just run through some of the things that the homemakers do. Watching children, 44 hours a week. Housekeeper, 17 hours. Cook, 13. Dishwasher, 6. Laundress, 6. Food buyer, 3.5 hours. Chauffeur, gardener, maintenance, seamstress, dietitian, practical nurse. When you're done with that, it comes out in today's terms to an equivalent of $23,000, or $23,100. Now, that's an enormous economy that is not measured. It's the informal economy. And this one is saying that there are a lot of things that can be done in the informal economy. I can paint a house for you. We can have great musical talent early in the morning and not have to pay for it, if you can find someone who can sing the blues. There are enormous things that can be done, and they're saying there'll be more of a movement into the informal economy. And that would be, they say, more humane and can be more ecological and sane. Who does this appeal to? Optimistic people, people who like to participate, people who are reflective, people who are creative. Well, let me just make a couple summary statements about these five models. There's only one model or one scenario that does not stress the future, and that's the first one, business as usual. It tends to be a little more short-run in nature. Troubleshooters. What are the problems today? We go from problem to problem. Does not always take the long run into account. There's only one model here which holds that catastrophe is inevitable. And that's the second one, disaster. The last three models all say or share a very serious concern about the future. They say disaster is avoidable. However, they disagree on how to avoid that disaster. Number three, the totalitarian conservationist method says that we've got to clamp down by force. The hyper-expansionist one says we're going to break out from the past problems. Have enormous growth. And the last one, the sane, humane, ecological, the initials, the SHE, future, says we're going to have a big breakthrough. We're going to look at development, we're going to look at economics in different terms. Okay, the TC, number three, and the HE over here tend to be elitist and centralist. I mean, there's a hierarchy there. There are people on top. The SHE tends to be more egalitarian and puts more emphasis on decentralizing, getting people more involved, having more control over what happens. By the way, I have many additional things to say about five if people want to hear about that later, and I assume that we will get to it later. Okay. Both the HE, four, and the SHE, five, are very optimistic about the future, but very different directions. The TC tends to be fairly pessimistic. And I've never had the opportunity to live under centrally planned economy, but they are inefficient. And although they sound like good solutions, there are a lot of problems, even though they solve some. At least history has said that. The TC, three, and the SHE, both stress conservation, a cutback. And of course, the HE is expansions. Now, in order to analyze these three or to comment on them, I want to just pose a few problems or a few questions for the scenarios, then to give us a little some ammunition to work with, something to think about as we try to answer the first three questions. So in these scenarios, the first question is, how do you feel about each scenario? If we're looking to the future from a Christian, from a responsible point of view, how do you feel about each of those? B, which do you prefer of the five? By the way, I might add, I don't think we'll ever see only one. There will be parts of all of them. It's an emphasis you put on one. C, which do you think is likely to be the closest to the actual future that will happen? You're looking in the crystal ball. Which one do you think is going to happen? Which future will we take? Now, some of the questions from past sessions, which might help us answer those first three questions, or you just may want to bring them up because we haven't had adequate time for discussion on some of the issues. The first one is, do we need to change our definition of economics? Unlimited wants, limited resources. How to try and produce more and more and more in economic terms, goods and services. B, can moral development take place in capitalism? Would you allow me to just go through the 6 points of Kohlberg's moral development stage? I think it's fascinating. I had never seen it, and I'm not, this isn't my area, and I'm taking a risk in even talking about it, and I haven't even read him. I've only heard people talk about him twice. But this is what I had in my notes. He said there are 6 stages to moral development. The first stage is one of obedience and punishment. In other words, how do you make a moral decision? Well, in the first stage, it's very simple. You tell someone, if you go ahead and do that, you're going to be punished. And very easy to understand moral decisions then. Someone else did it for you, and there was a threat backing it up. Very authoritative. The second stage we go through, and someone else can comment on whether or not these are stages that you evolve through from 1 through 6. They say you tend to go through these stages, but if you can skip for how that works, I need some input. The second one is one of equality. It works like this. If you break my toys, I'll break your toys. We'll come out equal. If you play nice with me, I'll play nice with you. And so you're always stressing equality. You scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. We'll get a little more into economics, out of toys. Okay. The third one, I missed the name on this one, so I gave it my own name. I'm just slaughtering, I think, Kohlberg, but I call it the wishy-washy basis. You want everyone to be your friend. So you wait before you make any moral judgment until you know where your friends are coming from. And so on one end of the hall, you may be very much in favor of alcohol and getting completely smashed. And then you go to the other end of the hall and you find out the friends don't like it. So you say alcohol is a bad thing. And that's how you make your moral judgments. The fourth one is one where we want something stated in absolute terms. It must be very clear. That means there's nothing left for you to decide. We have a good example of that going on at Luther with our alcohol policy. The students want to know how many people can be in a dorm room, because you can have alcohol in your room, but not in the corridors or anywhere else on campus. They want to know how many students can be in the room so that it's legal to have a small party. Now, they're trying to figure out the number. You can help me, some of the Luther students, if it's 3 or 4. But once that's set, you see how it takes away any responsibility for a moral decision? You could have 3 people in the room and have your stereo on 10 and just be causing all kinds of problems for people, but you'd say the rule said we could have 3 or 4. On the other hand, you might be able to have 15 in a room and respect the rights of other people. And so if everything's in absolute terms, it takes away our responsibility of making decisions, moral decisions. The fifth stage is one where we stress negotiation and cooperation. You get together, you talk to the different sides, and you try and figure out what the right answer is. I think it's approaching what Matthew Fox calls compassion, where you sit down and you care about the other side, and you try and figure out what would be best. That takes work. And then the sixth one is that you've internalized at least number 5 so well that you don't have to sit down and start negotiating, work through things. You just know how others are going to feel. Now, can we go through that stage of development in the system of capitalism? Does it allow us to do that? Third one. Are the economic costs of growth, or I should say, are the costs of economic growth, if I wrote that wrong, are they greater than the benefits we're now receiving from economic growth? And I guess I put a few things on the board, but see if I can summarize that quickly. Physical limits, what are we doing to the environment, pollution? There are social limits, what's happening to our relationships with other people? Psychological limits, institutional limits, we become so congested, so big, that can we get much bigger? more bureaucracy, and then the what's happening to our ideology? Is it losing some of its credibility? Are those costs that outweigh the benefits of a higher standard of living, more material goods? Then the fourth one, can capitalism solve the energy, the inflation problem, the moral problems that we're experiencing? Now, those were some questions to help look at the three models, or five scenarios, I mean. The last part is a Christian framework. Yesterday, Larry gave us the term, is it oikos?
Mm-hmm.
And you correct me, Larry, because you could define it much better than I could. But it has something to do with balance and interrelatedness and living in harmony with the environment and other people. And that you can take off on it if you'd like to say something right now.
Just to say that the word itself is a way of picturing the world as a single public household where everything is then, by definition, interdependent and is the root of our words economic, ecological, and ecumenical.
Okay, thanks. And then stewardship may fall under that, is maybe very closely related, so that may be a duplication. But then from a global perspective, remember of God's whole creation, the human family is all of the earth. And then shalom. Shalom is a powerful, powerful term. A friend of mine, Jerry Folk, who is at the Shalom Research Center and also teaches a little bit at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, says that shalom means, and I'll give you five basic things here, wholeness. It means harmony. Each part must fit perfectly and harmoniously into the whole, which I think in many terms is going back to this term oikos. And it's cosmic in nature, the universe. Second, it originates in God, shalom. God who liberates the oppressed and seeks justice. That's where it's coming from, the term shalom. And what is justice for all on earth? It's also a very normative idea. By normative, I mean what ought to be happening. It's a vision. It's a dream. It deals with the transformation of this world. It calls us to action. Fourth, it's an ethical challenge. We are to minister whenever we find people who are oppressed, in poverty, discriminated against, who are suffering. Justice is an indispensable part of the term shalom. And then also the cross is very important in the term shalom, where Jesus is at the very heart, and we live in forgiveness. But those are just a few concepts that we might think about. And now what I'd like to do is just open the floor to anybody who wants to say anything about the first four sessions, anything about these scenarios. Express your views. Where do you think, as responsible Christians, we should be going in the future? What do you think we should do? What can we do? How can we actively be involved? And then, let's see, I went about a 25 minutes, half hour. I need to have a good 10 minutes at the end to make a few summary statements that I would like to share with you if they don't come up in the process of discussion. Anybody willing to take this one on? Or even open it up or get it started? Yes.
I just have a question. I was wondering if you could briefly just state the major writers in each of those five areas or something.
They tend to say that there is no proponent of number one. No one sits down and writes about it. We just all live it.
Everybody lives in this stuff.
Yeah. And number two and three, let's see if I can find something in this book. I know Heilbronner is associated with it, a person by the name of Ronald Higgins. I'm not a futurist. I mean, so that I these names, some don't mean anything to me. Heilbronner does because he's an economist. The one for the totalitarian conservationist is, they have the names here of Herman Daly, Garrett Hardin, and William O-P-H-U-L-S. Hopefuls?
Yeah,
Hopefuls.
I wouldn't put Daly there.
Where would you put
him?
Okay. Okay, fine. Then Herman Kahn and Daniel Bell tend to be put with the fourth one. And the last one, I mean, being this book is called Sane Alternatives, we'll put James Robertson there. I think that for me, Schumacher could be put there. Well, here, on the last one, I'll say something about resources instead of waiting till the end. Let's see if I can find where I jotted those things down. as far as the fifth one goes, for me, I think at the micro level, what you do right where you're living, I think Matthew Fox is very important. If you want to go to the international scene, the book I found most readable and most useful because it talks about action is James McGinnis, Bread and Justice. Now, there are quite a few books out, but that one's just very down to earth. You can read it, you can understand it, and it talks about things you can do. And then The Sane Alternatives by Robertson. If anybody elaborates on number five more, I mean, I wouldn't know who it is. I mean, most of the book's devoted to it. And then also, I'm really emphasizing five, but there's something called the Shakertown Pledge, and the Quakers have done some work, like Taking Charge. It's a book that they have out. There's probably many, many other sources, but those, I think, would be some of the key sources.
Mary has quite a collection of books in the bookstore, which you're saying, especially the two, but some of the others as well. Have you had an opportunity at the new bookstore? I don't know if you've had a chance to see it. Gilder's Book on Wealth and Poverty, which is kind of the rationale for Reagan economics. And the one that David Stockman has been handing out like pencils. The reason I ask that is because it strikes me as being not simply business as usual, but something between that and your fourth one, and which makes me wonder whether Stockman's economics isn't four in order to get a better version of one.
Okay. When I first read this, I just automatically put Reagan here, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I saw the supply side economics. But then as I read a little more, I began to see that, well, Reagan wasn't really talking about some real, you know, rapid expansion using science and technology in ways which we don't normally think of, and into the next 10, 20, 30 years. But I don't think there's any, if you had a spectrum or continuum, I don't think Reagan would be, if this was on the left side and this was the right side, Reagan would be on the left or the right. I think he'd be closer to left than right, but certainly he would border to some extent on this. I mean, maybe there's no controversial issue here as far as what people want. We had to talk about number five. On the other hand, if we're going to be realistic, you want to? Yes.
The thing that I appreciate about number five is I think it puts the responsibility where it belongs on each one of us. I think for so many of us, there's a tendency to say, well, our leaders should tell us what to do. If only we had good leaders, if only we had a good man, of course, to lead us, then we would not be in this situation. And if only the Savior would come, if only we would elect the right president, the right congressman, and so on, all of these things would go away. And I think that's a very dangerous attitude, and it's extremely common.
I agree with the lady. She said it very well. I don't think, as I look at this, being the first time I've had any exposure to this, there's a little bit of all of it to be taken in to a person's mind. But I lean toward the fifth one, because Jesus taught one-on-one basis, more or less. He sent out his disciples. He didn't call upon the government to do anything. He called upon people to do it. And if you're talking about this in the aspect of Christianity, then, as the lady said, the responsibility falls upon us. And if we assume the responsibility for ourselves, for our families, then the leaders we have will take. Well, that part would take care of about itself. But I think there's a danger in that fourth one, in that you get starry-eyed. And everybody says, well, God, it's all going to come out fine, so why should I have to do anything? Or why should I worry? The disaster, we're getting that now. myself. I was going around there and shaking my head, and the prophets of doom, we're done for, we're sunk, we're no good, our kids are no good, families are no good, nobody's any good, and that's wrong. We only hear of the spectacular, the stuff that makes juicy reading. We don't hear about the families I see around here. So I lean toward that fifth one, but I think you need to be careful that you don't get all wrapped up in just one thing.
Yeah, Gandhi says that there's some truth in all sides. You just have to know where they're coming from and look for it. And so I think it'd be dangerous just to wipe first four off the board and go to five. Just a couple of terms to relate to what the two of you already said, and then maybe some of you want to continue that. But one term is macro and the other term is micro. And this tends to be a little more macro, where things are done at the national level or above. And the same with this, you depend on those at the top to do that. And when you deal with macro, then you're hoping for trickle down. And so that's another term, it'll come down, it all will benefit. If you take five, you're really emphasizing the micro a great deal. Now, I don't think anybody thinks we will fully decentralize. We will ever go back to being small entrepreneurs and small farmers and small businesses. There's a lot of room for that, but it's going to have to live side by side with large corporations, which we hope can become more democratic in that they bring in the consumer and the worker and management and everybody to make some of those decisions. When you go to the micro, I start as a macroeconomist. That's how I'm trained. To go to a ministry in some other country and make run up big computer projects. Oh, we had to learn all of this math, et cetera, to help them develop. And people down there, when I came down to do my dissertation, by the way, I didn't want to do that one, but my department wanted me to do that one. So when I arrived, they said, oh no, not another linear program. They said, here, look, and they had a shelf, just full. And they said, nothing is happening to them. They're just sitting on that shelf. Nobody, even if you could put it into place, nobody knows what's going on out at the micro level. Why don't you go to the micro level? And I said, fine. I pulled out my briefcase, my first proposal to work in grassroots development at the micro level. And ever since that experience, I've been more and more and more interested in the micro level, the work that should be done there, because it does put more responsibility on us. And when the micro, if it works, it builds, and pretty soon it has its impact on the macro. Yeah.
I kind of like to see myself falling between four and five. I don't see where they're mutually exclusive.
They both talk about growth, but in different directions.
Yeah, I hesitate sometimes.
I think the third question over there about the cost of economic growth and the benefits is part of the answer to that question. I don't know about space exploration being Christian or un-Christian. I've never thought about that. But at least in five, when they talk about a closed system, you have to come face-to-face with redistribution of resources if you're going to help someone out, and it forces you to think of those who are around you. I mean, when you expand, I guess, you don't have to think about others. Maybe everybody will get a piece of part of that expansion. And it does, that part I agree, it does take us away to some extent from asking those kinds of questions.
Are we too big for number five? Are we really too big? I mean, are there too many people, for example, in the United States, which is a relatively unpopulated country, are there too many people to be managed at the local level? I mean, you can't run a city like that. Can you? And is there room to move all? Is there arable land to move all the people out into small farms or small cluster communities? I also am looking at a combination of four and five. If you stay with number five for transportation, what do you stay with? Cars? You're never going to get a mass transit system on five. The parts of five that are saying appropriate technology is really incorporating number four. There are proper macro technology, transit.
Well, China tried to produce steel and blast furnaces in the backyard. It's inappropriate.
Yeah. Something else, I think there's a misconception about space travel. Nobody that I know of that's talking about space travel is seriously considering using it as anything more than producing products for the Earth. There's if you look at the numbers, it's impossible to move the Earth's population off the Earth. No one's ever talking about that. We're not talking about abandoning the Earth when we're talking about space travel. And all you have to do is play with the numbers to see that. All they're talking about is using that technology to produce things for the Earth.
Sort of half comic point with respect to yours, I see all kinds of movies, including a second-rate remaking of High Noon called Outland, the exact remaking of High Noon in outer space, where they're mining titanium at plutonium. And speaking of the medical doctors here, the woman medical doctor there is the greatest actor in it, even beyond Sean Connery. She considers her a failure for being out there in the boondocks rather than on Earth. And it's not a compliment to any of them. She's a marshal. He considers himself a failure for being there rather than on Earth. So at the end of the movie, they're coming back to Earth. And I'm Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly. We're going to walk through the store, a Quaker grocery store.
My tendency is certainly toward five. And I grew up in a space family. My father is an aeronautical engineer, so I just grew up that was good stuff. And when the space shuttle did its thing recently, I was really torn between, is that a good thing because is it useful, or is it a terrible thing to use resources that shouldn't have been used that way? And I think the key is, five is most of the answer. We need to use some of four, but we don't use that out there technology until we use that technology for in here. That may be the key in my mind. Is don't start saying, well, we've got problems here, so we'll go out there and find some answers, and maybe they'll solve these problems. It seems we need to solve these problems, and then maybe access for one.
I want to do something at this moment. I know there's a question back there and one here. And remember, and I'll call on you. But I think what I need to do is move into five and go a little bit further and give you some characteristics of what five might look like. Because it's a little bit vague right now, the difference between four and five. First of all, number five, I'm going to give you 10 characteristics. The first is that energy and resource use will reflect the principles of ecology. In other words, the economic system is part of a larger ecological system. I think you talked about that yesterday, Larry, that what we've done with our non-renewable resources is we've been able to work 24 hours a day by using coal. We don't have to wait for the sun to shine and live with the rhythms of the earth. So that there'll be some, they'll put some stress on renewable and recyclable, and agriculture would be different. And I know the question you raised was, if we all go to that kind of agriculture, can we feed the whole world? Part of the answer here is that maybe we won't be able to feed as many, but this kind of a solution would help many of the third world countries who would end up being able to produce much more food too, and that would take care of some of those problems. Okay, the second point is that less waste. You stress durability and you recycle, etc. Let's see, I've got something that we learned at a retreat center. It's called the 5 R's. I think that fits in here. What you do with something before you throw it away is you repair it, you reuse it, you reclaim it, you restore it, or you reactivate it. And after you run through those five, if you can't do one of those things to it, well, maybe you could throw it away, or find a new technology, find a new way to recycle it. You put an emphasis on that, so that you're not putting a lot of input in and then getting a lot of waste. Things get used over and over and over again.
What are the five again, Mark?
You repair it. You reuse it. I mean, you try to do one of these. Mm-hmm. You reclaim it. You restore it. Or you reactivate it. Check all of those before you throw something. And build a bigger garage. Third, people come first. So if I didn't say Schumacher in five, I should have said that. And things are second. It means when you produce goods and you distribute them, it's very people-oriented. It doesn't necessarily say you move away from big companies or whatever, but in the process of making those decisions, you get all the people involved. It's far more of what we call an economic democracy, which is just starting to emerge. Now, we've got some plants in the state of Iowa that are worker-owned now, because they've had problems and they saw no other solution. There are movements in that direction. Fourth, it stresses greater self-sufficiency. Self-sufficiency. As an economist, I need to say a lot about that. All I have ever taught in economic theory is that you specialize. You do one thing and you do it well, and then you trade. And by doing that, we produce more goods with the same inputs. I may show that sometime next week in the course when we deal with international concerns. But anytime you talk about more self-sufficiency, you are automatically talking about a lower level of living. There's no way you can avoid that if you're going to do more things yourself. Now, people who talk about the formal and informal economy might want to argue about that a little bit. But specialization is what brings more production. So how would you be more self-sufficient? Well, one would be in energy. A second one would be in transportation. I can't read my writing, so I'll have to move on. Number five, it's going to be more decentralized. Not completely decentralized, but where it can be done, you should try to do it. When firms can be small, when decisions can be made locally to handle some of the problems, you make movements in that direction. In fact, the author has a scheme in the back where he talks about six changes, and within each change, 30 categories that you can look at within those six major changes. So what's 6 times 3? It's 180 areas where you can sit and brainstorm and try and be creative. Because clearly we don't know what it's going to look like. We're just starting to do the thinking. We need economic democracy in big business. We need more small businesses. They're worker-owned or community-owned. Now the sixth point is, in the international economy, it's going to change. We will become more self-reliant. Again, as an economist, that just contradicts anything I teach about international economics. Because in international economics, we all specialize in trade. That's how we all get richer. And this is saying be a little more self-reliant, take care of some of those problems at home first. And we may be forced to become a little more self-reliant because I don't know how long the South is going to continue to trade their resources to us. They should decide maybe it's about time they hold some of them for themselves. That may be forced on us a little sooner than we expect. Seven, appropriate technology is important. By the way, that was what my dissertation was on. And that's a tough term to work with. It sounds real good on paper, but you have to be so creative. You really have to work hard at that. That's not an easy thing. And our mindset doesn't help at all when we think big is usually better, complex is better. Eight, there will be some rural movement from the cities. There will be movement, migration from the cities to the rural areas. But they say only limited. Maybe the best they can do is reverse the trend. No one's saying it's everybody back to the rural areas. I mean, they're not saying that at this stage. And nine, it says that there will be greater economic equality, more equality. Because without growth, we're going to be forced to deal with those who are poor and less fortunate. And then 10, the whole relationship between work and leisure and life will be much more integrated, especially in the informal market. And I'll just say a little bit about that informal market. They talk about the formal market and the informal. It's a nice little diagram in there. And the informal market's fascinating. And having read that in the last couple of days, I don't have very much spare time here at Hull, and I don't know how the rest of you are going to feel about that. But if I could find a little bit of spare time, I would really like to do a little economic study on the informal economy at Holden and calculate the GNP for Holden. I'll bet if I took those hours, but of course I have to see how productive everybody is when they're working, but if I could take all of that, I bet, you know, if Holden, they're talking about the possibility of a small farm somewhere. With the exception of food and a few other items, I think Holden maybe could become fairly self-reliant. I don't know that much about the specifics. But what would the GNP be? Look at all of the work that's supposedly going on and all the things that are happening. It's kind of fun to look into that. Well, now, let's move on. That gives you a little more idea of what this number five would look like. Now, do you still have the questions here?
A couple comments. One, an observation, one comment. And you talk about the big garages. And it would be kind of interesting because we're talking about smaller houses and now you're talking about garages the size of the house.
I should have thrown that in. I should have said just buy less in the first place and you wouldn't have ever needed that garage.
We live in the garage.
The other part of it is coming up here, my week of before I got this vacation, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal that our technicians, scientists, have now developed the possibility to explode a bomb up there in the atmosphere that will completely disrupt much of our technical transmitting equipment through the rays and through the interference it would set up. It would interfere with power sources and power supplies, transmitting, even recording devices. They don't have to, apparently, now, if they continue with this, explode the bomb on the earth and destroy citizens and cities, that sort of thing. They can just wipe out the whole technological community in its ability to transmit.
I hadn't heard that. The one that I usually hear is that the United States is ahead of the Soviet Union in developing laser beams from with satellites that can deactivate any missile shot by the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union feels that we're a couple years ahead of them in the development of that technology. And so when you talk about a nuclear war or whatever, that's always scared me a great deal, because I was afraid that if we get, that gives us first strike capability. I mean, if they can't fire, we deactivate anything they fire. That puts us number one. And I've always wondered what the Soviet Union would do. I mean, they don't trust us any more than Reagan appears to trust them. And would we be backing them into a corner? But now that you've told me that we have another bomb,
I brought the paper
take care
with
of everybody.
Me. I don't know where it is. I left it for someone to read up in the hall, and it's gone. But if someone knows of a Wall Street Journal around here, and they ought to pick that article out and read it. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, right here. Right here.
I was going to say, to me, the bottom line for technology and the problems with it is, you know, when it's taken out of perspective, when you don't look at the moral aspects, you know, like atomic weapons or whatever, you know, it's absurd if you look at it from a moral dimension. And I think that might be the difference between technology in 4 and 5.
Is that you would have teams that would monitor technology and try and make those decisions?
I don't know.
Something to think about. Yeah.
It seems to me, I have a couple of questions, and they're interrelated. I'm, of course, attracted to option number 5, so, like I should think any sane person would be. But I think there's an attitudinal problem that one has to address. All that is so reasonable on a pragmatic level. But part of the attractiveness in American society, I think, of option number 4 is that basic American frontier spirit, that there's something that has to be radically reversed there. We've always been pushing off into the unknown, going west or going up. And I think that's almost a kind of a basic urge of the American spirit right now. And secondly, related to that, I read a frightening quote yesterday by George Will in the New Newsweek, who says, referring to some kind of romanticism of the Empire State Building, said this: "More than the Statue of Liberty, the Empire State Building represents the basic urge of American society. More is better." That's related to the first comment. And if that's true too, we have two extremely difficult attitudinal problems to deal with if we're going to go back to option number 5.
Yeah, you're answering the third question over there about what do you think is likely to happen. And you're talking about what is in the past, for the frontier and growth being very important. Lauren Halverson talks about 3 settlements of the United States. First was by the Native Americans. The second one was by all the immigrants who came in and had the frontier sort of cowboy economy spirit. And he says, now we desperately need the 3rd resettlement, and that is, we're here. How do we live with each other? Because before, if you couldn't live, you just moved west or whatever. Now we're more or less stuck, unless we go into space, let's say. That's pretty expensive. We need a 3rd resettlement, and I think the question you're asking is, can we get that settlement, and what's going to happen when it rubs shoulders with the frontier spirit?
Right.
That's a little tough. Yeah, we've had it. Yeah, I'll get right there, and then I'll come back. Mm-hmm.
you talk that more self-sufficiency will result in a lower level of living.
It will for us in the United States. Yeah, I'm not so sure in the third world.
Do you mean just material? I mean, do you see that in connection with the material quality of life?
I'm talking about the formal economy. The only economy that I really understand.
I mean, so
I'm not talking about the informal one necessarily.
So that, I mean, the increase maybe in quality of life we gain by going back, I mean, more stress on personal relationships
and
stuff like that.
Personal social growth is quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, I was going to make a comment and express a concern, I guess, in terms of some of the things I've heard, which sound as if there's a, you know, there's a very deep suspicion of governmental activity involvement.
Mr.
And I think that's well observed. But nevertheless, I think to associate governmental involvement and participation in resolving, addressing these decisions as necessarily being totalitarian is really something we ought to not do. And that since these issues are very complex and society is very messy and very complicated, that as a part of number five is the appropriate and proper use of the political process.
Yeah, good. Okay, I'll get to Larry and then we'll get to
Just a quick follow-up to that. It's too bad we have no one here who represents the black inner city perspective. We're also inclined to number five and don't realize that in the way in which it is in fact developing, for example, Golden Village, tends to be classes and by omission, not intention, racist. If you take the strides that black Americans have made, it's been because of development at the macro level and with a large role for the central government. A decentralized self-sufficient community in Senator Helms of North Carolina isn't necessarily progress for black Americans. So there's a tendency here in number five to reflect the development, the talented, gifted, and relatively educated and well-off people are capable of doing, which is what we've had at Holden, and it's been a great story. But that's a kind of follow-up on this comment about the macro level.
And those two contributions are very important. When I study the environment, I teach environmental economics also, and the people who ever cared about the environment in general have been those who are well educated and rich. So the ones that can afford to either pay a little more or think about it. When you're poor, you just need the basics, and if you're breathing bad air or not, it's not a very important thing when you're still in the basic needs. Bill, I want to go up here because I think I've seen that hand on and off every once in a while, and I forgot, I haven't been looking up.
Doris, about the last two people have said very strongly and about having a Christian impact on Washington where the decisions are made. Talking with my congressman, Arlen Erdahl, and he said that he's given up on trying to figure out the Christian viewpoints as far as his voters are concerned because they get a wide variety of directly conflicting opinions from very staunchly Christian groups. And he's there to have to please the whole community of the whole first district. And so he's given up, except for what he thinks is best for himself. And so to think that there's a clear message of what is Christian is coming through to Congress is just, it's nonsense.
Larry's in another situation. He's come up with the Christian economic system.
Well, yeah, no, that's not mine.
No, I know. Larry takes the same point of view, but he got a letter yesterday that told him what the Christian economic system is. So we may have
I'll pass on the problem. We're two parables. We're going to integrate this whole week of parables and economics.
I'll take one more. Then I want to. Oh, I really have a few things that I do want to say at the end. So I'll see how fast I can say them, then we'll have a couple more minutes. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Maybe just expand on those two. Number five is really number one. Number four and number five really number one. I know that's a profound statement. in that, what, and answering what's likely to happen. What's likely to happen officially is number one. And what's likely to happen in that case is what the aspects of number four and five, which are successful, are going to take place. And what aspects of number five are going to be successful is unfortunately like, no, well, maybe unfortunately like vulnerability. An elite community of people who, you know, have the money, who have the talent, who have enough leisure time, who have enough space in their struggle to just survive, to come out and do this. Those are going to be people who are going to make number five.
Maybe that those who are doing that in number five will provide models for some of the others 75 years from now.
I don't object to that. There's a talk now about the creative middle. And I think that's suggestive. But there are great dangers there, and Luther pointed to them. It's forgetting the macro, it's forgetting the place of large role and for government and public policy that tells people this is the way it's going to be done, whether you've elected that on a micro level.
It was dangerous making a personal statement about micro and macro and saying that I had frustrations at the macro level. Clearly, we need people at the macro level. It will be there. And it just happens that let's hope that those that are in those positions will either respond or act responsibly. But I probably won't be the one seeing in the macro level. And how the rest of you all fit into that might be different. Let's see a couple things about responsible lifestyle. First of all, there are some things that I see that it is not. And I suspect that the people here at Holden have a much better feel for some of these things, but this is where I'm coming from. First of all, simpler lifestyle, or number five, does not mean poverty or austerity. It just doesn't mean poverty or austerity. Second, I don't see that it is a passing fad. I think there's quite a bit of that going on, not only in the United States, but around the world. So if you think nobody's thinking about it except Holden or a few others, there are a lot of people involved in it. It's not a back to the land movement. We may reverse the trend somewhat to the cities, and it's already you're seeing the center cities. Washington, that's tough. Some they've been leaving, but with transportation costs, they've been coming back, too. It is not isolation. I think if people think it means that you isolate yourself and you ignore the world around you and the needs, you completely miss the point of what responsible and simple lifestyles are, to, at least as far as I see it. And it is not going to solve the world's problems. If anybody thinks that's going to solve them, there are many fronts that need to be worked on. I suppose that's getting back to the macro. What is a simpler lifestyle? I'll just say a few things here. I think it's hard work. It's amazing that the term is simpler, because it is hard work. It isn't easy. Anybody who thinks that you're taking the simple, easy way out, I think is wrong. Two, it is risky. There are some real risks involved. Three, I think it's quite revolutionary. I guess that's maybe why I like it, because I'm an old conservative. But I'd like to think maybe I'm a little revolutionary. It requires a lot of commitment. It isn't something you just do without thinking about it. It emphasizes small scale when it's possible. It's human-oriented. I like that. It's far more human-oriented. It involves cooperation. In often cases, to get some power, you have to cooperate and join together. And ever since playing basketball most of my life and in college, I've found that cooperation is a lot of fun, but it doesn't always work, and I'm trying to find places where it will work. You need to be conscious of injustice. I think oppression and injustice are critical issues that you deal with. You attempt to interrupt the spiral of injustice. When someone oppresses someone else, part of your responsibility to try and do something about that, to interrupt that spiral. I would like to think it's nonviolent. At least that's where I come from, that it's nonviolent. It begins right at home. That's why I say Matthew Fox in the micro level. You don't do anything at the national level or any other place, I don't think, if you haven't got it figured out right at home. And it respects you respect yourself and you respect others. And it's how you act right at home that's so important. And then you make the extension. Then there are, it's evolutionary. Then there are three things that I want to really stress. It's creative. And that's exciting. And for someone like me who was just not taught to be creative, kind of a new and scary thing, and I don't feel like I'm very competent. But creativity is a wonderful thing when you get involved in it. And it really is catchy. I like that part of it. Two, community is important. Or not two, just one more, community. You're not going to do this alone. support groups, community, are very important. And then the one thing that we haven't talked about much here, I haven't heard it so far, and yet I know it's important, it just hasn't come up. Solitude, time for reflection, and rest are essential to a simpler lifestyle. We are so busy, we don't take time to do that, and we don't know how. If I were to ask some of you to spend 1 hour in a room all by yourself, reflecting and thinking, I bet it would be a scary thing. And you couldn't read, couldn't listen to music. Sit and just think. Reflect. Meditate. Why would anybody get involved with number five? Let me just give you a couple warnings here. I don't think anybody should do it out of guilt. That tends to be what my colleagues tell me is the Lutheran way to get at you. Make people feel real guilty. Get action. I'm not saying... Is that wrong? Is
it? Wrong.
Don't Lutherans say that?
Oh, no. I thought you were talking about the prescription.
Oh. Yeah. You do it on a voluntary basis. You do it out of love. You do it because you just want to do it. It is fun. I mean, that's the reason why you would get involved. Second, you take actions that are right for you. Yesterday we had a little session on gifts and talents. You work where you can work. You don't go out and try and make changes and do things where you don't have any talents. You'll be frustrated. It has to be right for you. It slowly evolves. When you jump in, you don't tackle the whole problem. You make very little changes. The first change may simply be, let's think of a good first change. Instead of just taking 2 trips down to the grocery store a day, you take maybe 2 a week. Just a very simple change, and then you gradually evolves. People who try to make a drastic change overnight, I think that'd be so hard on anybody's psyche. It would be an enormous problem. And then the last piece of advice, and I'll end on this one, is that when you work in the area, if you are experimenting with number five, I think one of the most dangerous things to do is to consider yourself Superman or Superwoman. Don't underestimate what you can do, but somehow we get the idea that I am Superman or I am Superwoman and I am going to go out and I am going to make those changes. I think that's dangerous. Now that may sound like a cop-out. Maybe I'm making it sound too easy. But I think if you jump in for the wrong reasons or if you try to start too big, too many changes, you're going to have some problems. It isn't easy. But it is. It's really a fun thing to experiment, to be creative, to sit down and have a problem and think through it, see if there's a different way of doing something. I guess when I think of it from a Christian perspective, it's just seems to be a good use of the talents and the skills that you have to put your energies in some of those creative areas. Well, it's going to be 10 o'clock in about a minute or two, so we'll close the session. And it's really been kind of a fun week. I came here to talk about international issues, but it turns out that the domestic issues are a lot more fun here than they have been in the classroom back at Luther. So, thank you.